We'll be taking your lawn and garden questions on Focus today. With summer in its final weeks, the changing of the seasons can mean a whole new wave of insects to bother your plants. Plus, there are preparations you may want to start thinking about for your lawn and garden with the cooler autumn weather just a few weeks away. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we welcome back two experts from the University of Illinois Extension, horticulture expert Sandy Mason and entomologist Phil Nixon. And they're ready to take your phone calls and emails on plants, flowers, grasses, trees, and the insects that can help or hurt them. I'm Jim Meadows. Our program begins after the news. It's lawn and garden advice time on Focus today. Hi, I'm Jim Meadows, and horticulture educator Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension is back to answer your gardening and lawn questions. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning.
And good morning to Phil Nixon, Extension entomologist, for questions about insects.
Howdy. Good morning.
Relating to lawn and garden. Well, thank you both for joining us today, and we are taking your questions about lawn care, gardening, the insects that come with them, and you can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And, you know, one of the first things I'm wondering about right now is I was looking at the weather forecast this morning, and I saw for the first time in a long while a forecast of temperatures in the 90s. That's supposed to happen about Sunday through Wednesday of next week. If that's accurate, they're forecasting low 90s and heat indexes in 100 or more. Does that mean anything for somebody's garden?
Well, I think probably the biggest thing is obviously we along with that we've had lower than hoped rainfall and actually lower than average rainfall in most areas, and so that ends up being the big problem. If we had plenty of moisture out there, probably a lot of plants would go on their merry way and they'd be perfectly happy. So people do need to think about watering, and certainly if they have within the last few years, if they have trees or shrubs they planted, just to really pay a little attention to them and make sure that you do water those, even if they've been in there for a couple of years. People may also notice in their vegetable garden, when we start getting to really high temperatures, sometimes tomatoes, the flowers will actually abort and the flowers will fall off and you won't get as much production. So they may see some problems there. And actually even the quality sometimes of the tomatoes kind of goes down as we get really high temperatures.
So they do not like the hot weather.
You know, they like warm weather when we start really getting into high 90s and stuff. And if we have a lot of hot, dry winds, that's when we tend to kind of lose some of the flowers. And also the fruit, for the most part, tends to get a little mushier, so people may find that it's really better off once the tomatoes actually go ahead and start to color up a little bit. They actually will be a better quality if they go ahead and pick them then and then just ripen them indoors.
Is anything going to really flourish when temperatures are in the 90s?
Well, I think all our tropical stuff, there's a lot of people that love things that, you know, that certainly have tropical plants and bananas and cannas and any of those tropical kinds of plants that we might think of that a lot of people love to put in their gardens these days. They're going to love this kind of weather.
Okay.
I've never seen my tropical bonsai thrive as much as it did last year with the hot, dry weather. And for those people that have potted plants, house plants that are sitting outside, they need to be watching them because they will dry out much faster than they normally would. We normally water our bonsai once a day or once every other day. On hot, dry weather, you have to water them twice a day typically.
Mm. So even if they thrive in hot weather, you got to be careful of right. How much water they're getting.
Yeah, they can transpire out all the moisture out of that pot through their leaves very quickly in hot, sunny weather. And so they can pull out the water that they have in the pot pretty quickly if that's all they're limited to, then you need to replenish that.
Maybe this is a good time to talk about potted plants, container plants, in general. And these are things that you can plant, I guess, because they can go indoors. Even though it's August now, you could plant something that's going to stay around through the winter.
You certainly could. I think for a lot of folks, maybe they've had containerized plants through the summertime, petunias or whatever, and they may notice that some of those are actually starting to look a little bedraggled right now as the season progresses. And so they may actually want to go ahead and do a little pruning on those. Actually, petunias will take a pretty hard prune if they tend to be ones that's kind of stretching out and not looking all that good. I'd also really think about fertilizing your container plants this time of year, because after we've been watering and watering and watering and the plants have been in those containers all season long, you really do need to think about fertilizing. So you may want to go ahead and do a little slight pruning and fertilizing. People may also decide they just want to, it's time to sort of replenish them and sort of forget the plants they have in there now. And they might even want to think about some of the more fall type plants that we certainly have out there. Even mums and stuff are starting to be available. So they may find that they want to start all over again that way. Those are probably more outdoor type plants, but certainly if you have some that you want to take inside, I've taken impatiens indoors in the wintertime, and actually a lot of plants that we might typically think of the garden plants actually do fairly well indoors as houseplants.
Are there certain plants then that are just going to die off when the colder weather comes, and maybe just die off at that time of year, even if you bring them indoors?
I'm not sure necessarily probably most of the plants that we have issues with as far as dying off is that they're just not winter hardy, and they die often simply because it gets too cold. I can't think of anything in particular that I would think of that would just automatically die off anyway. There's some of them that tend to go dormant during the winter season, even if you bring them indoors. I'm thinking of things like the herb lemon verbena is one that just tends to want to go dormant anyway. So there's a few plants kind of like that. There's Brugmansia just happens to be one of those angel flower type plants that people like to have. They just tend to go dormant even if you bring them indoors.
If you have annuals, they will die off, but you can extend their growing time. Things like petunias, marigolds, things like this, particularly marigolds, you can prune back and they will survive then into the fall past when they normally would, but there comes a point when they run out of gas and
you can't take a petunia inside and keep the air moist and nurse it through the winter until next March.
You certainly can. Petunias tend to get a little depends on how much light you have. You know, if you have supplemental light or you have a sunroom or something where they're getting plenty of light, they'll probably be okay. I've certainly brought in geraniums, begonias, impatiens. A lot of plants we typically think of as just annuals actually do fairly well even indoors as houseplants.
But maybe they're really not meant to be long-lived anyway.
It just depends on how much effort you want to put into them. I mean, most of these are actually tender perennials. In other words, they're perennials. If we were in a warmer climate, we just don't happen to be at that. So if we were at a warmer climate, they would be perennials and they'd hang out and they'd live year after year. But we just happen to be in an area where it's just too cold for most of these plants. So we let them die off and then we buy new ones in the springtime. So
this is Focus on WILL AM 580, Lawn and Garden Time today with Sandy Mason and Phil Nixon from the University of Illinois Extension. And let me give our phone number again. It's toll-free. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And you can dash off an email at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we're talking about, I guess right now we're about 9 days before Labor Day. And so even though it is summer now, it eventually will not be. Are there things that are good to be thinking about and doing right now before the autumn comes?
Well, I think one of the things is this, certainly as we start getting into September, it's sort of our do-over time, which I kind of like in the sense that it generally cools off enough. Hopefully we get some rainfall that you can start thinking about planting things again. So trees and shrubs, if you want to go ahead and do some planting on a lot of those, that works out well. Perennials. So there's a lot of those kinds of plants that certainly you could plant in September. If you need to think about renovating your lawn or putting in a lawn, we're actually reaching that point where this is really a pretty good time to be thinking about redoing your lawn or thickening the lawn up by adding seed, those kinds of things.
This is the time for major lawn surgery in August or just?
August into September. Usually the last couple of weeks of August and then into the first couple of weeks of September is usually a pretty good time to be starting on a lawn, because hopefully a little rain once in a while would be nice so you don't have to water quite so much.
You shouldn't let that go until until later in September or even into October.
Correct. You don't want to start the grass too late, simply because if you start it too late, then it's not well established. And then when we do get into cold temperatures, they have a tendency not to do as well. So you really want the plants to get well established. And that's really true for perennials and trees and shrubs. It's nice to give them some time where there's a little bit warmer weather so that it can go ahead and send out some new roots and hopefully get well established before we get into really cold weather.
Okay. Well, we have a caller coming in on line four. Good morning, Robert from Terre Haute. We were talking about tomatoes earlier about how hot weather affects them, but it sounds like you have a different problem.
Yes. I never had it before, but the birds are attacking the tomatoes, or they were. Hmm. As soon as they get ripe, they must be going after either insect or worm or something, but I never had the problem before. Do you have any ideas about what's going on?
Generally, what they're going after is water, and they're normally not going after after any insects associated with it. With it being hot and dry like it has been, if you put out a bird bath, your problem with your tomatoes would probably cease. Tomatoes are a great force of moisture if you can't turn on the hose and get a drink. So generally it's been my experience that that providing a source of water for the birds normally greatly reduces the amount of tomato damage you're going to have. Usually what they do is they're poking out at the bottom and getting the most moistest part of the tomato. Any caterpillars that might be on it would be tend to be more towards the top. So they're really going after moisture usually. Considering the weather we've been having, I'm pretty certain that's the case. Give them a bird bath.
Well, it kind of looks like they dig a hole in there. Like,
yeah, they will. They will peck at it and get the moisture. Normally, what the damage that I see, if they're going after the moisture, is usually the latter bottom half of the tomato has got a number of pecks in it that are, and I've also seen it where they only do a single hole, but I've always associated with moisture, particularly since when I've looked at those tomatoes, I've almost never find any evidence of insect damage in them.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much, and let's go to another call on line one. I believe this is a roll from Chicago. You have a tree problem?
Yes, I do. Actually, the tree problem is located in Iroquois County at my farm, and I have like a sunset maple, which is like the hybrid between a silver maple and a red maple, and the tree's been in for about 5 years, but the last couple years in about mid-summertime, I've been getting a blackness around the edge of all the leaves on the entire tree. And I'm just about ready to give up with my tree, with this tree, and try something else. This is in kind of Sparta soil, Sparta 88 soil, so it's very sandy, silty soil. Was wondering if Sandy has any ideas for what that is or how to treat it or what's going on there.
I don't know if you've been able, have you been able to water it all?
Yes, I do. I water it, but, you know, I'm only there probably once every couple weeks, so... you know, at a time like this when it's really dry, you know, I'm not watering it probably as much as it would like. And, of course, you know, being on a farm with the pump in the water, you don't have that much water available. I usually am using it for my garden and other things.
Yeah, I'd almost bet it's probably because you probably have a certain amount of wind involved, too, when you get into rural properties especially. So I have a feeling it's probably just a heat stress issue between heat, lack of water, those kind of things. And maples kind of do that, especially some of like the red sunset. I've certainly seen that where they really have a hard time with, and especially it sounds like with your soils being a bit sandier, and that kind of all adds up to the fact that they're probably a little water stressed. So it may not be the best selection when it comes to that particular area. I don't know. Do you have it mulched at all? Like a little?
Yes, I do give it a. I do give it some compost. You know, when it was younger, I mean, this is like the fifth year, I was giving it a lot of compost, and you know, so I think it was pretty fed pretty well, and I was taking good care of it. It was staked well and whatnot. So
Yeah, I'd almost bet that's probably what it is. They do get a bacterial leaf scorch, but not necessarily looks black. It certainly looks brown around the outside edges, or kind of a beigey to brown on the outside edges. So that would be a bacterial thing. But you, and that can actually get worse every year. So I'm not sure, other than just watering, I'm not sure there's a whole lot you can do for it. So it may be one of those things where you just decide, I don't know if you have another area where this tree could be moved to, or whether you just want to decide you want to go with something a little bit different.
Yeah, I think I'm going to probably try. I was thinking of trying maybe one of the hybrid elms that's resistant to Dutch elm disease. That might be a little tougher.
Elms are going to be much more drought tolerant, right. So would hackberry. And then, of course, all of your needled evergreens are dry weather plants, or most of them. So pines and spruces and so on could handle that situation better.
I got about 100 of those, so
they're probably doing fine.
Yeah, good luck. I mean, they're great trees. It just happens to be that sometimes they're just not the best tree necessarily for a particular area. So it sounds like you need to try another one.
You got to realize that where both silver maple and red maples are found in nature are in bottomlands alongside creeks and so on. They like it fairly moist.
Yeah, that's what I was suspecting. Okay.
Yeah. You might even try some, and I don't know how you feel about oaks, but actually like bur oaks, and they're great. You know, they kind of like that kind of hot.
I do. As a matter of fact, I've got a couple white oaks and red oaks, and the white oaks are doing real well.
Yep. Okay, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Wolf. Right, and let's go to line two. Peter from Joliet, you're on the air on Focus.
Thank you. I have two questions, both of them revolve around orchids. And the orchid in question, I have difficulty pronouncing. I believe it's Phalaenopsis.
Or Phalaenopsis?
Phalaenopsis.
Phalaenopsis, maybe, the moth orchid?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
My first question is, I've bought these that were relatively small and beautiful, and then I've bought others that seem to be maybe twice as large and very beautiful. Thickness of the stem and the size of the flower. And I'm told the latter is a orchid tree where the former is a orchid plant. Is that correct?
No, I've never quite heard that. It probably has more to do with maturity, just how old the plant is.
Many of the orchids have dwarf strains as well, and it might be an orchid versus a dwarf orchid. That might be more likely to be the case.
Yeah. I look for the big ones, and I buy the big ones, and when my greenhouse didn't have any more, I asked could they order them, and he said there was only two places he could get them from because he called them were orchid trees, and they do seem to be quite a bit larger than the other orchids that are available.
Mm. Yeah, the only orchid trees I've seen have been cases like in botanic gardens where they take an old tree and place orchids on it, epiphytic orchids up on the branches.
You mean
graft them
on? Or?
No, they just sit them on there.
Okay.
In the rainforest, there are a number of orchids that make their living by living up into the trees and catching debris and then the rain as it comes down.
That's a
natural place for them to be. Yeah.
My second.
But they don't get woody.
My second question is, when these orchids are brought inside and they finally die, do they go into dormancy? And if you would just keep them, would they then rebloom at a later date?
Yeah, they really don't go into dormancy in the sense that they sort of lose all their leaves and kind of what we think of dormancy. Dormancy for these guys would be they're not in flower. But usually you certainly can keep them year after year and get them back into flower. I actually have a Phalaenopsis that, believe it or not, and actually I can't even believe this, I bought it back in September of last year, so it's almost a year old now, and it has never been out of bloom. It's bloomed the whole time, and it's still got buds on it, so I'm just amazed on how well it's done. The one thing I do notice with Phalaenopsis is that you don't want to overwater them. They really are ones that they like a little bit of moisture. It's just like what Phil was saying, is that these plants would typically be up in the trees where they'd get a little bit of moisture, kind of maybe even on a daily basis, but a very tiny bit of moisture. So when you overwater them, I think that's when I've seen they probably have more trouble than anything. I think people tend to overwater the moth orchids in particular. So it's really one of those, you just give them a very light watering.
And orchids are something that orchids are something that need fresh air, and so it's very helpful to move them out in the spring of a year. But generally, you put them in a shady area underneath the trees or something like that, where they do get the fresh air, but they don't get the higher sun that their leaves really aren't used to. If you've had them out in a more sunny condition and move them inside, those leaves are not going to be adapted to the lower light that you've got indoors, and they're going to tend to they're not going to go dormant. As Sandy said, they're tropical plants. Dormancy doesn't happen that much except to dryness, but they will lose those leaves, or the leaves will get peaked looking, and orchids don't produce new leaves very quick, so you can really hurt your orchid pretty badly by having it in a sunny location outdoors in the summer.
And if they do lose their blooms, I was told that if you would prune them down to the first nobule, from the top, going down one nobule and cutting them off there, that would help their rebirth. Is that true?
Well, sometimes you get a second flower stalk. Maybe that's what they're talking about. I'm not sure about rebirth.
Seed energy.
Well, you've answered all my questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck. Yeah, sometimes they'll actually send up another flower stalk, or actually a flower stalk off of that main stalk. But they have to be pretty darn healthy and pretty vigorous, so you don't always see that happen. But it's a good thing to do, to sort of, because you never know. You might be surprised.
Okay. Well, our thanks for Peter for calling in. I want to bring in an email question here from Mike, writing, I know salt does not discriminate, but is it a good option to use on weeds in an area where nothing else grows? Will it affect the health of a large tree if many weeds surround it?
Salt is nothing we would recommend. because, I mean, there's a reason why plants don't grow in the great salt deserts and stuff. There's really a good reason. So it's not anything that we would recommend on a regular basis to try to control weeds just by using salt.
Unless you really wanted nothing to grow.
Unless you truly wanted nothing else to grow there.
But
I wouldn't recommend it that way.
And I don't know if Mike is perhaps writing about perhaps a shaded area in a tree where nothing's around a tree where nothing's
right.
growing.
It certainly could hurt the tree.
Okay.
It just isn't something that we would recommend.
And as gardeners, we look at ourselves as being stewards of a land, and putting salt on the land is just ruining it for decades and decades. And, you know, it just goes against the grain of Sandy and I to take a piece of soil and ruin it. I mean, that's just not right.
Especially our great soil here.
Right,
it's
exactly.
It's just wrong.
Okay, well, that sounds like a pretty clear message from
Yeah, really.
I mean, you can't get much clearer than that. You're a steward of this land. Don't ruin it.
Okay, well, let's go to line one before we go to the break. And line one, this is Jan from Urbana. Good morning. Hello. You're on Focus.
Hello. I have a question about a lilac. It's about a five-year-old lilac. It's been in the ground at least half of the day sunny, and it's been doing pretty well. But this year, it has not the normal leaf at all. The whole plant is kind of wilted, and the leaves are curled under and yellowy. And then I noticed there is a hole on the trunk, a small borehole, and then there's a real lively hole with some amber-colored goo coming out of it. And it looks like there's something digging into this trunk.
You may have some lilac borer, also known as the ash borer, not the emerald ash borer, but regular ash borer. They attack both trees. Both plants are very closely related, ashes and lilacs. And generally, we control lilac borer by pruning out the larger growth. It really doesn't get into anything any smaller than a cup, inch or two in diameter, usually 2 or 3 or 4 inches of diameter. And so generally, by cutting out the big branches, you can reduce the problem of lilac borer, or essentially eliminate it. Usually when you have lilac borer, however, you have the branches just generally don't leaf out very well. They don't wilt. The leaves don't wilt like you're describing. You probably have some borer in there. It may be lilac borer. It may be another one. But with a oozing and gooiness, I tend to think that you may have some cankers, which is also something you avoid by cutting out the big stuff and letting the suckers grow. On a standard lilac, Serica vulgaris, the worst thing you can do is to eliminate the suckers and try to keep the big trunks. You want to do just the opposite. That renews the plant. And I just got back from Rhode Island, and in there they have some ones that they and went to Plymouth Village, and they have some lilacs that were planted by the Pilgrims and are still there because they were managed right. They cut out the big stuff. They're almost immortal plants if you do it correctly. So I think probably it's that when you have tree lilacs, you're up against it, and that reduces the longevity of a plant. But when you have regular bush lilacs, cutting out the big stuff is usually your best deal. Sandy's it's probably got some to order.
This one looking so bad. I mean, the leaves are pale. You know, they're all pale. And the leaves are pretty much uniformly curled. Do you suppose this is a plant that's beyond help? Or should I try just pruning it down to the ground and then waiting for another season and see what happens?
As gardeners, we have an exceedingly difficult feeling of things being beyond hope. We normally prune and pray. and see if it'll come back next year. It may have just too much top growth for its root system. It may have lost a good share of its root system due to the drought and the heat of last year. And this may be what's coming by. And by pruning it down to the parts that you want to try to keep, you may be able to, what few roots are left might be able to salvage the plant. But I don't know about Sandy. I mean, she's the same as I am. Never give up on a plant until it proves for sure that it's dead. It just doesn't come out the next spring for a while.
And I think lilacs really are one of those. They have a few leaf problems. They have some other things. And sometimes they can look pretty darn ratty by the time we get into this time of year. But then next year they kind of do their thing. So they're, you know, if you can water them, that'd be great. Do some pruning, as Phil mentioned, and even mulching a little bit and try to help it out. And you might just be surprised at how well they come out of it.
With our wet year we had earlier in the spring, we do have a lot of powdery mildew on lilacs, making the leaves look kind of bad. And once they've been whitish, they can kind of look somewhat like what you're describing, but normally more just a whitish look. And that's associated with the weather.
I didn't notice too much powdery mildew, but we did ignore it last year. It was too dry. And then we didn't prune it, and now we're paying the price. I think I'm going to prune and pray.
And a little water and go for it.
Right. It's a beauty. It's, you know, purple.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break now on Focus, and we'll be back with more of your lawn and gardening questions. And I think we have a caller waiting with a question about pruning shrubberies. Stay on the line. We'll get to you next. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, back here on Focus with horticulture expert Sandy Mason and entomologist Phil Nixon from the University of Illinois Extension, taking your questions on lawn and garden care and insects as they relate to lawn and garden care. Our phone number, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Let's go to line four and say hello to Beth from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I just have a question about whether it is too late to prune some buddleia and lilacs. I heard what you said about the lilacs, but I've got a couple of buddleias that are just massive now, and I just want to reduce the size some.
Yeah, I think the buddleia, the butterfly bush, actually, some of them really got large this year, I think, with that plenty of moisture we had early. I assume has it pretty well quit flowering. I know mine's still in full flower at this point. But
Yeah, there are just a few flowers come out.
I would do a light pruning. It's probably kind of a tough time to do a lot of heavy pruning on things, simply because it is, you know, hot and dry. If you want to do a light pruning, just a few inches off, you know, 6 inches or so, I think that's not a problem whatsoever. But if you do deadhead them, they do tend to continue to flower. So it's kind of nice to continue to have those flowers. So, but if you do more pruning than that, then you probably aren't going to have any more flowers this year. So that would be the one thing. And then next spring, I definitely do some. I usually wait until they kind of start to sprout out so I can see what's still alive over the wintertime, and then do a pretty heavy prune on it next spring.
Ah, okay. Also, I was wondering how you get rid of yellow jacket wasps.
Yellow jackets are normally, if they're in a ground nest, they will take over an old rodent burrow. I tend to prefer that you try to coexist with them if you can. Mow that area late in the evening after sundown and mow it quick and get out of there. because they will tend to come out and they follow light, so don't have a light. Don't turn the lights off. Don't have lights on your mower. But at any rate, if you got a riding mower. But you can kill them in that type of a nest with a pyrethroid, probably permethrin. So it is 8-insect spray or other material mixed with water and just poured into the hole. More commonly, we get the yellow jacket nests in the walls of buildings, particularly the German yellow jacket, which is so predominant here. And yellow jackets going in and out 2 or 3, 4 or 5. A dozen a minute will this time of year indicates a nest, and putting Carbaryl or Sevin dust, S-E-V-I-N dust, around the opening, they'll pick this up and get it on their hairs and groom themselves, feed each other in a colony, and kill off a nest in a span of several days. And because it's a wasp nest, there is no honey or anything like that in that nest. Bee store honey to make a fruit of winter. Wasps make a fruit of winter by overwintering females. The whole nest dies off anyway. So there is no reason to try to remove a yellow jacket nest inside a wall. Yellow jackets are going to be about a half an inch long, yellow and black banded.
Right.
And they're not bees. So so that's an effective method of eliminating them. And you do need to, because as it gets into winter and they get cold, they will chew through your inside wall, and you'll find them inside your house. You don't get them rid of them in the wall void before it gets cold.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's go over to line two. Line two, Rick from Crawford County. I understand you have a question about Japanese beetles.
Yes, this is for Phil. I wonder if I have been amazingly lucky this year. I have dozens and dozens of rose bushes, mostly antique ones, but some David Austin's. And I have seen this year 3 Japanese beetles, and 2 of them were not working on rose bushes, but rather on morning glories. Have they gone away, gone west, and have we need to stop fearing them?
Yes and no. What we've noticed for probably the last 6 or 7 years is a band from about Monticello, Illinois, north to Onarga, and south to Charleston, east, all the way across Indiana, and most halfway or more across Ohio, in which we've had, for some reason, very few Japanese beetles, a quarter to a third of what we would normally see. For many people, that's way too many, but still, it's a lot less than it would have been. And that area seems to be spreading. We saw some evidence that it might have spread as far back as Springfield this last year. The other thing that's involved in that is, in the dry weather we had last year, many people did not water their lawns that much. They watered them enough to keep them alive. And the white grubs that are the larval stage that feed on turf, they are the larval stage Japanese beetles. They need 11 inches of water from the time they hatch in late July through the fall. And if you didn't water so much, you didn't give them enough water to survive, and a lot of those died off. So it's a combination effect, but hopefully you're in Crawford County, you're getting into that area where we're starting to see some die-off. We've had them looked at by insect pathologists and things of this nature. They can't figure out why they're not surviving well, but they aren't. And, you know, it's we kind of like know what's causing problems so we can kind of spread their problem around a little bit, but we don't know what it is yet. But, yeah, it's be cautiously optimistic that you'll have good roses again next year, but don't count on it because it may have just been the dry weather last year.
Okay. I never water my lawn. An additional thought occurred to me. Maybe all the fierce rainfall we had this year, maybe they drowned them out.
No, they really loved the rainfall we had this spring. That's not a problem for Japanese beetles unless the soil is saturated, and that didn't really get that way for that long.
Thank you very much.
But, yeah, that's the dry weather more than anything else would have knocked them back. And because Japanese beetles can go as much as 15 miles, it's reduced watering in a large area that helps reduce the beetles.
Thank you very much. And that reference to not watering the lawn brings up a question at the back of my mind that I thought of when you brought up the fact that now is the time if you want to do some major lawn work between now and early September. I'm asking for a friend of mine, a homeowner who really hates to mow the lawn. He hates everything involved with lawn care, and I almost think if he could pave the lawn over, he would. But in thinking about his problem, I was wondering about so-called low-maintenance grasses I've seen advertised that apparently just grow very slowly, and maybe they have other properties that perhaps are useful as well. Do you know anything about this, and will they have the effect that my friend desires, which is to be as little trouble as possible?
Yeah, I think it is. There certainly are some grasses out there that are what might be considered lower maintenance, like turf-type tall fescue. And tall fescue is actually a grass been around for forever and often used in pastures. But now there's a turf type, so it actually is a little bit, I think, probably what people typically think of as a turf-type grass, so a thinner leaf blade. And it's not like Kentucky bluegrass, which is what most of our lawns are around here, which tends to be a grass that likes more moisture, likes more fertilizer. Tall fescue is one that does better under low moisture, does better under low fertilities. And so some people have kind of moved in that direction. But I will say that I have part of my lawn is in tall fescue. And I will say it actually grows faster in the spring and fall than the Kentucky bluegrass does. So absolutely, it does better in hot summer weather. You don't need the water, and it stays green even when there's not much water. But it does tend to grow faster in that spring and fall. So it actually needs to be mowed a little bit sooner if you're really at that point. Probably the other thing, maybe even to, you know, there's some interest in buffalo grass and some of those native grasses, native to more westerly areas, that tends to be a smaller grass. It's another one of those. It's a warm season grass, so it brings some issues in how well it actually performs as a turf and how well it actually competes against some of those cool season weeds that we have come in. So I think there's a lot of things. It's not, I wish it was simple and we could just say, oh, plant this and you'll never have to do anything to it again. I'm not sure it's quite that simple. So people really have to look at what are my expectations for a lawn. If you want that, you know, Kentucky bluegrass, looks like a golf course kind of lawn, you're going to have to put some inputs in there. So fertilizer, water, and stuff, because we just don't have grasses that are just going to do that on their own.
I think this guy's hope is for something that doesn't give him much trouble and doesn't let in many weeds that would outgrow the lawn and present something else that he has to deal with.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's really a good one.
I was out east a few years ago and saw a lawn that was probably a half an acre large, maybe 3/4 acre, was solid English ivy.
Oh,
no,
wow.
Grass whatsoever.
Wow.
More trees will reduce how fast your grass grows, and eliminated some. And you know, I'm sitting next to a horticulturist, so I have to be a little careful. But you know, it's one of my favorite ground covers that you don't have to mow is called Creeping Charlie. Mm. And anytime I get underneath tree canopy very much, the Creeping Charlie tends to kind of take over, and I see it as a benefit rather than a problem. Because when it gets out in the open, I have good soils, and the Creeping Charlie is choked out by the grass.
Okay.
But it was brought in as a ground cover.
Creeping Charlie may be something my friend finds attractive. I don't know what his neighbors would think.
Yeah, well, you know, he might need a buffer zone or something.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, let's go to line one and say hello to Jeff. I know you're on the road. I hope you're still with us.
Yeah. No, I pulled over so I could talk to you. I have three ash trees, four, and three of them are easement trees, and the other one is in my backyard. Now, I've been treating them, I want to say, for like 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, and they're doing really great. I mean, there's the usual dead stuff in there, but the bug hasn't seemed like, if it's in there, it's probably, I don't know if it's gone or what, but all the trees around me where they haven't been treating, they're basically dying off, and, you know, they're pulling them out. But my question is, I don't know how long I'm supposed to have these trees treated.
Rule of thumb is until all of the untreated trees are dead and have been gone for a few years. When I've talked to people about using imidacloprid or which is the merit type material, or an imimectin benzoate to have a triage applied, or of a safari, the dinotefuran, you're normally entering into probably at least a two-decade process here. You're probably going to have to treat that tree once the emerald ash borer gets close enough to attack it, which is within 15 miles of a known infestation. Probably you're looking at treating that tree for 20 years before all of the other trees around are pretty well gone. And we're seeing that now in some of the western suburbs of Detroit, where apparently emerald ash borer first started up in Michigan. And they first picked up on that one, I think, in 96. And it had been there for probably 10 years. Do the math. We're 10, 20 years down the road, 25 years down the road. And they're getting to a point to where now you get to a point to where eventually there are few enough emerald ash borers out there that the guys and the gals just can't find each other.
The other thing is, too, I was wondering if the ash tree is ever going to come back again, because I know that decimate the whole tree. I know out west, and I was in a little bit of arbor culture myself with the Forest Service, they have lost a whole entire species of tree virtually. That's why they're having such a problem with the fires out there to begin with. And, you know, I hate to see that happen with any tree species. I'm just wondering, can you bring them back, or are there people out there experimenting with tree species to maybe make them a little bit more less inviting for bugs? Anyway, I'll get off, guys. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
I caught a little flack for this in the beginning years, because I made the comment that one of the biggest problems we have with emerald ash borer is that we have insecticides that will control the insect. If we had nothing, then the trees would all get killed off. We could wait a few years, and then we could come back and plant ash trees and not have to worry about it. But because we have we can treat the trees and leave a few ashes or a number of ash trees with a few emerald ash borers around, we may never get rid of the insect, because it is a one genus tree host. It can only insect can only go after ash trees and fraxinus species, and so there will still be some around, and we don't know for sure how few of trees we have to have before the emerald ash borer just can't make ends meet and can't really survive well. There should be a point there somewhere, but we don't know exactly where it is. We're kind of learning this along with everybody else. But where a tree is completely eliminated, you could actually come back after a few years and replant. Usually there's something hanging on. The chestnut blight is a good example of that. We lost all our chestnuts, 120 years ago or something like this. But there are still root seedlings coming up, and they get big enough to get chestnut blight and keep it going. So it's a very, very difficult thing to eliminate completely.
Okay, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about garden and lawn care for Sandy Mason and Phil Nixon with the University of Illinois Extension. The phone number, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. The email address, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller on line three. Luis, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Good show. And actually, the two original questions I had have changed a little since you guys have been talking about types of grass in the lawn. We're starting a new flower bed alongside the south side of our garage, full sunlight all day, but I was contending with a vine type of grass. I don't know if it's, I've heard anywhere from a Bermuda grass to a Asian vine grass to creeping Charlie. I have no idea what type it is. It's not impossible to kill. I sprayed some Roundup down before I dug up the flower bed to get rid of it, but it is going to have to be something I'm going to deal with when I put the new flower bed in. Our garden got took over by it when we tried it, but I guess, so that question I guess leads into what's the best way of keeping that type of vine grass out of a new flower bed?
Well, I think it's probably just to deal with it before you actually plant things, to be honest with you. It's much easier to deal with it then. And there are a couple of perennial-type grasses that tend to get a little weedy, and nimblewill is certainly one of them. Actually, Bermuda grass is one that actually can come in as a weed. And both of those have fairly small leaves, and not very long, but they spread. Quackgrass is another one that will spread just by underground runners. And those are all perennial grasses, and so they're really, really difficult to control because of that, because especially like quackgrass, even if you try to pull it out, it'll pop to the point where you'll still have some roots there, and then it'll send up new shoots. So those are perennial grasses, the hardest ones to deal with. Certainly there are some annual grasses out there, and crabgrass would certainly be one that's going crazy right now, but that has to come back every year from seed. And we have a number of other grasses that are annual grasses, and they're coming back from seed, and those we can sort of deal with a little bit differently, and that, you know, mulching usually helps, so you don't have open soil areas dealing with them now, so you can get rid of some of that those seeds certainly. Certainly even some pre-emergent type herbicides can be effective on these annual type grasses. So probably the first thing, to be honest with you, is to get accurate identification of what you really have. Sure. And whether it's an annual or perennial, because it does make a big difference. But the perennials, I will tell you, is so much easier to deal with in the very beginning before you get other things planted. Because as you know, they sort of intermingle themselves with everything else, and then they're almost impossible to try to get rid of when they're in among all your good stuff.
Right. Okay. And then with that flower bed, like I said, it's a brand new flower bed. I'm bringing in some new dirt from the Urbana Landscape Recycling Center.
Mm-hmm.
I have a bunch of perennials that I, from seed or from bulb, I started this spring, and I'll have bloomed like some Canis, some gladiolus, and some other lily type flowers. The gladiolus are blooming, the canis are starting to bloom in the pots. Should I wait till they're done blooming before I transplant them into the flower bed? I heard you were talking earlier about September being a good time to you know, redo or remake what you started. When would be the best time to transfer these plants into the flower bed, the new flower bed?
Well, certainly if you've got them already in pots, you could go ahead and plant them out. And of course, glads and cannas are not hardy. They're not going
to
make it through the winter, so you're going to have to dig them back up again.
Yeah.
So it's fine. But the other ones, you know, if they're already in pots and you already have them, I think it's easier to get them in the ground and then you know, make sure you water them properly and all that good stuff. So I think since you already have them, I think I'd probably go ahead and get them in the ground, unless you want to go ahead and deal with this grass question. And I will tell you, if you can, you can certainly bring samples to our U of I Extension office, and other folks can take it to their local Extension office for accurate identification, because that's one of the things we do a lot, is just to help people figure out what plants they have.
Yeah, I think I will do it. It's a pesky weed. That's right. It shoots runners through the grass and then plants and then goes again. And you can pull one up and it zigzags across the lawn for 9 feet. So it's a pain. But it started in one of our neighbor's lawns, and it's been crossing this whole side of the street for probably 4 or 5 houses.
Oh, it could very well be Creeping Charlie. It kind of almost sounds like that. And of course, Creeping Charlie's in a grass, and it has kind of a roundish looking leaf, but it tends to be a little scalloped on the outside edge.
Mm-hmm.
It smells like mint when you pull it. I don't know. Does any of this sound familiar?
No, okay. I don't believe it smells like mint.
But I would take a look at that. Yeah, you might just want to bring in a sample and we can help you figure out what it is.
Great. Well, thank you for your time.
Sure.
Thank you for calling. And we have about 90 to a couple of minutes left. I have a couple of emailed questions. See if we can get through them quickly. Amy writes, we just bought a house. The elevated deck is surrounded with about 15, 2 to 3 feet tall boxwoods that smell bad and even worse in the hot weather. The shrubs are still fairly small. I'm wondering if moving them to a location away from the house makes sense or if it will be a huge amount of work to get the root systems out. And then what would you suggest replacing them with?
Yeah, I would think about moving them. That's just kind of the way boxwoods are. I'd probably wait and do it until the springtime. And they certainly could be moved. So that might be one of those things. It's obviously going to take some effort to move them. So it depends on how much effort you want to put into them. But I'd probably wait till spring. What can you put around them? There's plenty of other. It depends on how big they want things. But there's some nice, like some pink spireas that are really nice. Certainly some of the smaller lilacs we've mentioned before. So there's a number of smaller shrubs that might do quite well in those areas.
Okay, and here's one last quick one from Randy, who wants to split and transplant some bearded iris, but wants to wait until the hot weather is over. That's forecast for next week. How late can I transplant bearded iris this year?
Yeah, I actually, you can't hardly kill those things. The thing they don't like is too wet. So I wouldn't wait way into October or something where it might be cool and wet. So they don't like cool and wet. So you certainly could do it in the next few weeks and they'd still be fine.
Okay. We are out of time, but thanks for all your questions. And thanks to you, Sandy Mason and Phil Nixon, for answering them. Mm-hmm. Sandy and Phil with the University of Illinois Extension. Plenty more information from the U of I Extension at their website, web.extension.illinois.edu. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Monday on Focus, we note the 50th anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington with our guest Bill Smith. He's a Champaign-Urbana native and University of Illinois alumnus who took part in the march. Plus, U of I history professor Sudhiata Shajwa will be with us to help us understand the impact of that march on the civil rights movement in America. That's on Monday's show. Remember, Focus is broadcast each weekday morning at 10. There's a replay at 8 p.m. here on AM 580. You can hear Focus over the air on AM 580 online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs on demand. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.